Recovery
changes every week.
Yeah.
Are we ready to go?
Welcome to Recovery in the Middle Ages, the podcast about two middle-aged dads navigating life, love, and the pursuit of recovery.
Yes, we're pursuing recovery.
Were you recording just then?
Yeah.
Great, great.
So should we get
so
going?
Happy that was, that's
going
to be
where are
on.
We going?
I don't know. Hi.
Hi, everybody.
Oh, Jesus.
Welcome to week three of Recovery in the Middle Ages, the podcast about recovery, addiction, and living your best, most authentic life.
That was good, but I thought I said it okay. You know, I thought I nailed it in the intro. But
should we go back and start it again?
I don't think so. Okay. I kind of like this. This is.
I'll do like I've done the last couple of weeks and sort of trickle it in.
Trickle it in. You just do like an 80s. Yeah. You know, fade in.
Right. Very Howard Stern.
Yes, absolutely.
That with less, you know, sex.
Less sex, absolutely, a lot less sex. Well, I'm not going to expand.
Definitely
on
back
this.
Here.
There's no sex happening in the back of my shop, which is where we're recording.
Right. The storeroom.
Yes, the storeroom.
Every podcast needs a origin myth.
Right.
And this is ours.
In the interest of anonymity, I will not reveal what kind of store this is or where it may be somewhere. I'll say we're in the United States of America. And that's about as far as I'll go.
And it's not a head shop.
Not a head shop.
That's it.
No, we're not in a head shop. But I hope everybody had a great week. I hope everybody got a chance. By everybody, of course, I'm talking to all three of you. And thank you for listening. If anybody actually did get a chance to listen to the first two episodes, I hope you enjoyed it. I was actually reading, I started reading up on how to promote a podcast. Which
that would be a good thing that we should have maybe read before we started, but here we are.
So in how to promote a podcast, it actually says you should have like three episodes in the can on the day that you launch, right? And which would be great. So, I mean, maybe we considered today the first day that we're launched. This is our launch day. This is what we should have waited for today, and then boom.
Except none of this was in the can. It's just sort of on the fly.
It's on the fly. There's no can. right. No can. And here we are, though. We've got some great things to talk about. I think what I do is we go all week, basically. We talk to each other over text, and we think about things like that we want to talk about.
Right.
I don't know if you're like me, that you think about things, as you're going through your day and say, oh man, I got to talk about them on the podcast.
Yeah. I jot them down in a little notebook.
Yeah. I love that. That's the Moleskin. The Moleskin
is legit.
Right.
Helps me organize my disparate.
Makes
mind.
You feel official.
Yeah. Well, you know, why are we doing this podcast now?
Great question.
I think we're doing it to help people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, aside from helping ourselves.
Absolutely. You know. I would love to help at least one person, least of all myself, but most of all, that would be wonderful if I could help myself and maybe even you.
So to any of you who are listening, who are still struggling with alcohol or drug addiction, there's a way out. There's a way forward. There's lots of places to get help, and there's lots of people who would be happy to help you. So
please reach out.
Reach out. You can drop Nat or I an email.
Send us
an email.
That's
one way to do it. Or you can use the Google machine and, you know.
Use your Google machine. Email mikerr@middleagesrecovery.com, natx@middleagesrecovery.com,
or if they want to talk to like someone more professional than two of us knuckleheads, they could, you know.
Right, call the police and have them extract you from your mother's basement.
Yeah. Or before your mother does it.
Also, Facebook. We have a Facebook group, and there's exactly two people that have liked it. So be number three.
Yeah.
Recovery in the Middle Ages. Find us on Facebook.
First five get a T-shirt.
Absolutely. And that's
once we
on
make
Mike.
Up the T-shirts, which we
have. Yeah, very good. We had a couple things we wanted to talk about today. day. We went over our housekeeping. I've got a little an outline here to help me stay focused. We're on iTunes. That's actually, I don't know why that's so exciting to me, but just to be on iTunes, it's not like it costs anything. You don't, there's no approval, you know, really. Like, you don't have to be good. You just have to submit it and have something. So we've done that, and we're on iTunes. We need ratings and reviews. I think there's enough material for you to make a judgment call and write something. That would be great.
Yeah, we'd especially appreciate a written review. That would be great.
It would be good. And, you know, we discussed earlier today, Mike stopped by, and before we recorded, we talked a little bit. And, you know, we thought we were talking about Mike's 1 year soberversary.
Yeah.
Sober anniversary. And we thought maybe there were some points we didn't hit.
Yeah. So, you know, when you were congratulating me last week on the year, and thank you for your thanks.
Yes, congratulations.
You also said, you know, that includes a year sober from any drugs. And I said, yes, of course. And then you said a year sober from, that includes weed.
That includes marijuana.
And I said, yes, that's true. And that is true.
Right.
But it got me thinking. I had to think about it for a beat there because, you know, marijuana, interesting. You should have mentioned that. And it did catch me a little bit unawares because, you know, in the last few years, marijuana has been legal in an increasing number of states.
But not in our state. I want to make that clear. In the state that we live, it is illegal.
Well, it's decriminalized.
Illegal.
It's an illegal.
Like a sick bird.
But as I travel around the country in pursuit of lawyerly excellence, was going to, you know, the great state of California, the great state of Massachusetts, the great state of Colorado. What do all those states have in common?
Hippies.
That hippies for sure, but cannabis is also legal in all those three states.
Right. Not your place of residence, but okay.
Not my place of residence, but Massachusetts. Well, shoot, that's giving stuff away. Yes. Massachusetts kind of butts up against our state of residence.
Yes.
So what I found myself doing was when I was going to these legal states, well, not California, because I'm not going to try to bring anything back on a plane at my age. I
mean, bad idea.
Yeah. But, you know, when I would go to Massachusetts, I would visit a legal dispensary for the novelty of it, really. I was never a huge
Did you have a glaucoma prescription? Like,
No, you know, the medical lines are much shorter. In those
are
places.
They? Yeah. I have glaucoma. I really need to get eye.
All you need is some ill-defined stress situation, right, and you're fine. So I would buy a little bit of weed and bring it home. And you know, I was kind of thinking like that buying that weed and starting to smoke a little pot again after many years of not smoking pot really was sort of a stimulus to sort of push me towards quitting drinking, because the thinking behind buying the weed for me was, well, maybe if I'm smoking weed, I won't drink quite so much. And, you know, to a certain extent, that ended up being true.
Right.
The thing is, I don't really like smoking weed. And I much prefer to drink.
Right.
So, you know, I'd have this weed around at home, and every once in a while I'd, you know, rip a fat bong. No, not really.
What would you say? Because
they sell vapes now.
Oh, could you vape? Yeah. Could you vape THC? I've heard of that.
You can vape it. It's just like any other vape.
I stick to vape. I've got a Juul myself. I haven't smoked cigarettes in 2 years, but I've never looked into the THC vape.
Now would not be a good time to start. I wouldn't recommend
it. An awful time.
Yes.
Considering it's illegal in the state in which we live.
You're always hung up on legalities.
I'm out of gray areas. I'm not on probation anymore. I'm a free man. I want to stay that way.
So anyway, circling back to my year of sobriety, way back a year ago when I decided to stop drinking, I said, you know what? I knew it was going to be difficult. So I said to myself, I'm going to give you permission to smoke pot if you find yourself really craving a drink, because smoking pot is less harmful than you having a drink. Now, that's what I told myself.
Right.
And
you, being your own sponsor.
being right.
Well, right, of course.
I'm full of wisdom.
And you're a lawyer, right? And what do they say about a man who is his own attorney or who's defending himself?
Right. Fool for a client.
Yeah,
right?
A fool for a client. Yes. So do you have a fool for a sponsor,
Mark? Well, sponsor assumes that I'm hewing to an AA model, but that's a whole other thing. But anyway, so the postscript to this is I ended up not smoking any of that pot.
Well, good for you. That's good.
Because just knowing that I had that escape valve for me was enough to take the pressure off whenever I felt like I wanted to drink. I could say, well, if it gets really bad, I can always go smoke pot. And you and I got into a little bit of a, I wouldn't call it, well, maybe it was a disagreement about
a bit of a
about
discussion.
That strategy.
Yeah. Well, look, I come from years and years of program indoctrination. And some of it I do appreciate, I understand, not necessarily adhere to it. But the idea that, look, recovery is not like you can't, I don't buy this moral relativism model. What does that mean? What's right for me is not right for you. What's right for him? Like, look, is human sacrifice right or wrong? Okay. I know that's kind of out there, but
there's a big gulf between human sacrifice and smoking a little pot.
You know, walk with me down this path a little bit. You know, when I was in my anthropology class in college, and my dad gets a kick out of these kind of intellectual quagmires, and he said, why don't you ask your anthropology professor, you know, is it morally wrong? Is it evil even to practice human sacrifice? And why he did that was he wanted me to spark this sort of circular debate that he knew there was no real answer to, but that, you know, if you come across a tribe in some far-flung, you know, some far-flung country where you discover that part of their process, part of their culture is human sacrifice. And from their perspective, this is part of their religion. It's part of something they must do. For them, it's doing right. But as a person with a brain viewing this as a, like, intrinsically, we know what's right and wrong. You don't punch an old lady in the face. There's no way that's wrong, like, right in any situation. So can you say definitively that it is evil and wrong to do practice human sacrifice? Okay, and so this is an argument for moral relativism, you know, is BS. Some things are right, some things are wrong, right? Left.
Well, okay.
You see where I went with that?
Most cultures on Earth have some sort of prohibition in their moral codes, whether it's the Hammurabi Code, the Bible, the precepts of Buddhism that forbid killing. So I think one of the universal human...
Right, but what about the ones that don't? Are they, is what's right for them okay? Does that make it right? Like, what's right for me is I smoke pot twice a week, and that's what's right for me, and that's what's good for me, and that's good. Well, but maybe there's an overarching, like, hey, you know what's not good for you? Smoking pot, getting high, using anything to get you out of yourself, just straight up, straight out, that's wrong. I mean, is that possible? Or are we really these moral relativists where what's right for you is not right for me and what's right for me is not right for you? Like, I don't know. I'm not sold on either one, but I think it's worth talking about.
Well, I think if you're going to head down that path with respect to pot, you have to ask the question about same question about methadone. You have to ask the same question about using benzos to get off of alcohol.
I'm prepared for this argument, honestly. So we can go down that way. I mean, methadone, right? If you are able, and because I got a lot of this for a long time, I was on Suboxone. The generic is buprenorphine. It was an opiate. It's a blocker and an antagonist and an agonist at the same time. And a lot of people who are purists in the program say, while you're on buprenorphine, Suboxone, even methadone, you are not clean, right? But when I was on Suboxone, guess what I wasn't doing? I wasn't calling my heroin guy day after day.
Right.
I wasn't causing chaos in my family. I wasn't, you know, leaving my job for 2 hours in the middle of the day to chase a dealer. And I wasn't getting high, you know. So am I really not clean? Am I not sober? And so, I mean, you can take that argument and just spread it across marijuana too. If you have, you know, because, okay, there's a limit that some of us have who are in recovery. Like if your doctor prescribes you something and you take it as directed, therefore it's okay. Some people will say, so long as your sponsor, you know, says it's okay. But like, who the hell is your sponsor?
That's giving your sponsor much too much power.
But that's what we do in program is your sponsor is this weird kind of godfather figure. Right.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's very complicated. And I think I'm just, I mean, I can keep talking about this and I feel like I'm losing my point here. What do you think?
I think you have to look at marijuana the same way you look at methadone. That if, first of all, marijuana is not a synthetic drug. It's a plant. It's been used.
Opium is a plant.
But heroin is a highly processed form.
From a plant.
From a plant. But, you know, if you're just smoking pot, you're smoking
cocaine
pot.
Cocaine is from a
right. Well, plant. You could get
right?
You could get so reductive it's ridiculous. Everything
yes,
is natural, right?
Of course. Right. It's all in the Lord's green earth.
But, you know, I would say, I mean, you look at the origins of Narcotics Anonymous and those early meetings. At the end of the meeting, they would go out to a bar and have drinks because the problem is not alcohol, it's narcotics. So if you're an alcoholic and you smoke a little pot every now and again to keep, and it keeps you off alcohol and you're able to function and all that, then where's the harm in that? I mean, I think the question you
sure.
have to ask at the end of the day is what is the reason that you're using whatever you're using?
Okay.
Right?
I agree with that.
So,
yeah. What are you doing it for?
Right.
You know, are you leaning on it?
For me, no. What I realized was I could get the same sort of, if not the same, a similar sort of relaxation from something like CBD or melatonin if I needed to sleep.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, upping my magnesium dose.
Right. But if you could if you could buy an eighth of marijuana from CVS, I mean, would that somehow make it better? I don't know, because then you're getting into like, you know, at what point are we accepting what is okay? Is it based on what the FDA approves? Is it based on what the states
approve? That's politics.
Is it based on your doctor? But this is what we come across. If anybody is out there in different groups and outpatients and inpatients, these are the types of things that you run up against.
I think there's a larger issue about abstinence-based recovery versus harm reduction recovery. For me, and I can only speak to my own journey, I am pro-abstinence. I am, you know, I can take the devil's advocate and argue in favor of people having access to marijuana all day long. But at the end of the day, for me, abstinence is the way that I've chosen to go.
Yeah, it'd be great.
I don't necessarily believe that is the path for everyone.
Right. And I agree. I feel like...
I think it's a lot easier a path, frankly.
You know, of course, you know, but like I have to think of myself giving someone advice. And if I have to give someone advice, I would say, don't touch anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, change yourself, meditate, whatever you have to do to get yourself in a situation where you are not feeling so uncomfortable with who you are and what you have to do that you need something outside of your body to change that. And that is really what they're trying to do. This is what the AA and A, everything A people want from you. They want you to rely on the G.O.D., the group of drunks, God, baby Jesus, whatever it is that you place above yourself. And anything you put under that, like marijuana. And some of these groups will tell you that if you're prescribed, you know, something for depression, that's you're not sober. And I think obviously that's insanity. But you know, I sort of understand where they're coming from. They want to say, like, look, if you shoot for the sun, you might land on the moon. So you go for abstinence.
Right.
Right. But then the question is, so if I'm shooting for abstinence and then I smoke weed a couple times a week, am I a horrific failure that deserves to be shamed? And I think the answer is no. The
answer is no.
That's what I think. But not everybody thinks that, right?
Well, you know, I go into the Stop Drinking subreddit that I've talked about before, and there's people who, you know, they're counting their days, what have you, and then they go out once and they beat themselves up and they think they're a failure and they want to go back and they have to reset their counter, and it's such like a traumatic experience. And, you know, I typically approach folks like that and I say, listen, how many days did you drink in February? And they say all of them. Okay, and I say, well, how many days did you drink in March? All of them except for one. And okay. I said, well, then you had a successful March.
Yes, you have improved.
If you look at it as you're not an abject failure because you pick up once in a month, what you've done is you have 98% of your days in that month sober.
Yeah,
is a success.
And I agree with that 100%. I've had these discussions with my wife too, because she's not an addict, not an alcoholic. And over the years, I would have these kinds of stretches. I would do 6 months and, you know, 1 month I would drink and I would shamefully tell her about it. And for her, this is like, wow, you're just not getting it. You're not getting it right. You're a failure. And I would feel like a failure. And the, whatever group I was in would remind me, oh, you got to start back at the beginning. You know, you're not doing something right. Go back to step one. And I don't think that is appropriate, honestly, as far as, you know, coaching someone to be better. Because even if you think of it like, you know, they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about alcohol as an allergy. And if you think about this as like a diet, if you were on a keto diet or a no-carb diet and you were able for 6 months to stay on your diet, except maybe once or twice you came off of it, would you look back on that and go, man, what a failure?
No.
Would you say, wow, man, I did pretty good? And you look at your results, more than likely you would see lower blood pressure and you would have lost weight. And it's only an addiction where we look at these, little screw-ups, as you could call them, or, you know, coming off of it a little bit as a horrific failure that starts you over and puts you like in a pool of shame. And I think that's not helpful, and it doesn't save anybody's life.
No. I mean, the whole thing about counting days, you know, I don't know. Is it a good thing? Because
for some people though, it's very helpful. They rely on it. And
yeah, but then
when they screw up and then they're fucked. Right?
Yeah. Cause and, you know, that's the whole identity.
Yeah. I had to use an F word to just live up to our explicit moniker on the podcast. So yeah.
Not enough F words.
No.
On my opinion.
There's not nearly enough frigging F words.
So, so here's the question, you know, somebody who has not had a drink in 6 months, and then last month they really felt like drinking, but instead they did a bong hit.
Well, okay. You know, but like, as somebody,
but they didn't drink.
Yeah, but that's not progress. I mean, like,
oh, is it?
Depending.
Isn't it?
Well, look, depending on the program that you're in, right? I mean, right. Or are you in a program? I mean, yeah. Is Mike in a program at all? There's no program, right? There's just I'm trying to manage my life and not get messed up, right?
I have a scaffold.
How about I'm not trying to piss off my wife and lose my kids? For me, that was it for a long time. I just don't want to piss my wife off. And I don't want to lose my kids. And, you know, regardless of everything I got from whatever program and legal, you know, that was really it for me.
I mean, here's the thing.
You know,
if you're out there, if you're using drugs and you're drinking a lot. Go to a fucking AA meeting. Like, don't get bogged down in the thinking of like, geez, I don't really, right. I'm not really sure if AA is for me. Maybe I should look at it in a different, I mean, just go to the meeting. You can decide a week later that it's not for you. And then try and, cause there's plenty of other shit out there. There's, you know, you got Refuge Recovery, you got Smart Recovery.
Right.
And then you got these, books like This Naked Mind and, you know, stuff like that. So
there's a lot out there and I like what you brought up there, because
there's a meeting everywhere.
There is.
That's the thing. 12-step is ubiquitous. It's all over the place.
It is. It is. And every meeting. And if you go to one that you don't like, it's like a fingerprint. It's about, or a church group there. It's the people who are in it. And, you know, like, look, Mike and I are at a point where we're pretty comfortable and we're not waking up every day, you know, craving a bag or craving a drink, you know, so it's easier for us at this point to have these sort of discussions, and it's not, but like when I was on the balls of my ass and all I wanted to do was use or have a drink, and I knew that if I did, I would literally be in jail because I would be tested. I was on probation and I couldn't stay clean. Okay. AA was perfect for that situation.
Right.
Because they put you in a state of alert. They put you, you know, at a, like, you know, all hands on deck. I can't do anything, you know. So, you know, that, I mean, and that's where I think like a spectrum of addiction is kind of an interesting idea. You know, sort of like you have a spectrum, you know, 1 to 10. You have where I was, you know, right about the time that I OD'd or before that or when I had my DWI. And where am I right now on my addiction spectrum? Do I consider myself a normal person? Absolutely not, because I can't have a glass of wine when I go out to dinner. And I can't, and for me, I can't smoke a bong once, twice, ever a week. So that, but that's for me. I know that I can't do that. But it's important to remember that depending on where you are, I mean, you have to triage, you know, take care of the emergencies differently than you do, kind of the maintenance, I think is really where we're coming from on this.
Well, you know, the whole model of 12-step is sort of looks at, say alcoholism or alcohol use disorder as a progressive problem that will eventually result in you.
It's a fatal,
right,
progressive disease.
For many people, though, you can be a problem drinker for decades and never reach those levels of depravity. And I think the recovery, I don't want to say industry, but the recovery movement as a whole is starting to acknowledge the fact that maybe this progressive to death model, while applicable to some people, is not applicable to everyone.
Okay. Interesting you said that. Now, in our show outline, and I'm going to give you some behind the scenes, we're looking to work a couple of things into the discussion today. Some of them is a book that we both have read, I listened to, called The Naked Mind. And you're bringing up some points that would be pretty salient regarding that book. But I see something on my notes that it looks like we have missed. And it says, and I quote, weed stories,
okay,
dash Mike.
Okay.
So before we go any further, weed stories.
Okay.
Go.
All right, here we go.
Yes.
So
we got weed stories.
Just a little background. Yes. You know, for me and weed, like most kids in the 80s, I started smoking weed. And the first time I bought weed, it was from a guy at the Catholic high school that I knew.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
Of course, the Catholic high school.
So, but anyway, I was working at a grocery store, and there was these twins that worked there, the Ream brothers. I guess I can say their name. God knows where they are. Mike and Scott Ream, God bless them.
Do you have their phone number?
They were these total burnouts who worked in the deli department. And, you know, I'm just this, you know, little Catholic school kid who, I guess I was like 16, and I always used to score my weed from the Ream brothers because, you know, they were moving
weights.
They were some heavy hitters out there. So I smoked a lot of pot at that age. And then I started getting into the Grateful Dead, and I started going to Dead shows, and I was, it was like wall to wall pot. Yeah. But it was interesting because the drinking age in the state that we live in at the time was 18 years
old.
No
way. You're not that old.
It is true.
Are you that old?
I am that old.
Wow.
But, but I had started school a year early. So when I went off to college, I was only 17. Most of my friends were 18 at the time. They had changed the drinking age as I was going to college because I figured, okay, I'll suck it up for a few months and then I'll be 18 in January. Well, that September they kicked the drinking age up to 19.
Uh-oh. That's
and
like Canada.
That not only screwed me, but it screwed up a whole bunch of other people that I started school with. So the natural reaction for everyone was not like, let's try and figure out a way to drink. It was sort of like, well, let's just smoke pot instead.
Yeah, that's illegal no matter what. Yeah. So who cares what age we are?
But I was going to school in a school in the Bronx in the 80s, and weed was...
The Bronx?
Yeah.
In New York?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't say I lived in New York. As I was going to
you
school...
You were going to school there.
in the Bronx. And... so weed was just as easy to get as alcohol.
Right.
So everybody smoked weed and, you know, whatever. So after a while, I started realizing weed wasn't really my thing. I started drinking more and the cocaine and all that. So anyway, fast forward. 1995, the Grateful Dead end. Jerry Garcia dies. I just completely put the weed away. And for 10 years, I don't smoke weed.
Right.
2005, I start dipping my toe back into the Grateful Dead waters, going to shows.
Yeah, you're blaming this on the dead, huh?
And, okay. Oh, no. There's no blame here.
It's Jerry's fault.
It's poor Jerry. So I started smoking a little weed. But a funny thing happened to weed between 1995 and 2005. Weed completely changed. So I was smoking this, you know, Jamaican or Mexican ditch weed, you know, back in the 80s and the 90s. By 2005, all this crazy ass Kind Bud was out there, and you know, the THC level was off the charts and everything. Yeah. 2007, I go to a Further show. Further being
the Further Fest.
The Further Fest. Further, right. Further's a band, a couple guys from the Dead, Bob Weir, Phil Lesh.
Yeah, I only heard stories.
So anyway, they played at Coney Island at the Cyclone Stadium. Okay. So I drive myself to Coney Island.
Very good. Great planning.
Right,
yeah.
Right, great planning. No I park. Over. There's no parking. The parking lots are all sold out. I park in the ghetto, like way the hell on the other. I hate to use the term ghetto. It's not politically, you know, correct these days, but it was pretty much a fucking ghetto.
Right.
So and I walk 15 blocks to the, you know, thing. So there's some pre-gaming going on. I'm drinking at a bar with, we meet these Australian people who had never heard of the Grateful Dead, da 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 da. And I run into an old college buddy there who is also a lawyer, but he always had the best weed, you know, even back then. Apparently, he continued to get the best weed as the weed got better.
As he got his Juris Doctor, right. The weed just got better.
So this guy, on an average day, is smoking, you know, a shitload of this weed that no human being should smoke. Like
he's got a high tolerance.
Yeah, high tolerance. So me, after an afternoon of drinking, I run into him inside the concert. He hands me a bat. You know those one-hitter bats?
Yeah. So you buy that at a gas station, right?
It fills it up, hands it to me, and I'm like, I'm going to be a fucking hero. So I suck down a couple hits. I have them refill it. I suck down a couple more. All of a sudden, I can't feel my face. I can't feel my fingers.
You got it,
I don't know what the fuck's going on. I go, excuse me. So I run into the porta potty, and this time the band's playing. I'm curled up into a ball in the corner of the porta potty, listening to, you know, Further to kind of struggle through their renditions of old Grateful Dead songs.
Right.
And I must have been in there for, you know, it seemed like 3 hours, it was really like four minutes.
4 minutes. Yeah.
So somebody, you know, knocks on the door. I
you
come
okay,
out.
Okay, man. Yeah. Are you listening to this?
I go lean on the rail to try and watch the show. And this guy next to me starts trying to talk to me.
Oh, Jesus.
And I couldn't even get a sentence out, you know. And he's like, dude, are you okay? And
I'm
like,
okay?
I am not okay.
When some random guy at a show like that asks you if you're okay.
You know you got a problem. So this is only in the middle of the first set.
Right.
So I leave. I just walk out because I'm like, I feel like my face is coming off.
You're like, I should drive home right now. That
I was
would be
paranoid
a great
as
idea.
Shit. I was questioning all the decisions I'd ever made in my life up to that point. And that's, but that walk through the back through those streets back to the car was the most scariest fucking thing I've ever done.
Right. And
then of course I got in the car and drove home.
And you drove home.
I did.
Safely.
Well, I don't know if it was safely, but I got home in one piece. And that was the last time I smoked pot until.
So this is something that you're saving for yourself for your later years. Someday I'd like to do that again if I'm not feeling great.
That put me off pot for another 5 or 6 years.
I think it should probably put you off pot permanently, no?
Well,
do you think it's not as strong now?
I was ready to try again in 2012.
So you gave it another shot.
I went to I'd won tickets for, now Further had stopped touring and they were replaced by Dead and Company.
Right.
With John Mayer as the guitar player. So I go to that show with Aaron and we're sitting there and it's very civilized. We had tickets for, the nice area with the nice bar and the food and everything.
You're a VIP.
VIP.
All right.
We sit next to some kid and he's got a bowl. And he's like, "Hey man, you want a hit of this?" Man. And I'm like, "Sure."
You gotta try this, man.
I take it. I take one long hit,
and
boom. I broke out into a cold sweat. I don't think it was weed. Honestly, I think it was either spice or some kind of weird fucking shit. My heart started going. And Aaron's like, every time you try to smoke weed, this happens to you. Why do you keep trying to smoke weed?
Smoke weed, imagine.
And I was like, yeah, that's a good lesson. So anyway.
So you don't have a lot of good experiences to draw from.
I don't.
So why in the world would you think to yourself, I have a year sober, but maybe if I put myself in a situation where I'm not feeling great, instead of drinking, I'll just do that.
No. This was my approach when I quit drinking. Not now.
You would never.
I'm not playing now.
Well, you just said you were thinking about it.
When?
Did I completely misread this? I thought you were saying now.
Oh, no.
Moving forward, I might use marijuana.
No.
Never.
No.
Well.
No. No. No.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a huge misunderstanding here.
I said back then when I quit drinking, I was giving myself permission to smoke.
So from now moving forward, there is no situation you can see for yourself.
No. I like sobriety much too much. My life is so much better.
Not even marijuana.
No.
So what was this argument we had earlier? You're just saying
because back in the beginning when I quit,
right?
I needed that. I needed to know that I had the freedom to do that.
So
I gave myself permission.
Okay, and you feel
But I revoked that permission.
Yeah, well, why did you revoke that permission? Because?
Because I didn't feel like I needed anything anymore.
Because it didn't help you. And are there people that should have
it did help me before I stopped drinking, cut down on my drinking. It did help.
It helped you cut down on your drinking, but increase your pot smoking.
It did.
Which helps you recover how?
But I liked smoking pot. Here's the thing. Okay. When I was getting the legal pot in the doses and I could see how much THC was in it, I wasn't setting myself up for that situation where I'm hiding in a porta potty screaming for my mother, you know?
Yeah, that's tricky. Right.
So it's, you know, it was a hit here, a hit there, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
But really, at the end of the day, I don't need anything, you know?
Right, and that's...
But back then, I didn't know that.
Of course
Because
not.
I was new.
Because you were only...
I was new to the whole idea of never having any consciousness alter.
You had just turned 60. It was 15 years ago.
Nice.
Yes. Buzzing.
The old jokes.
Yes. Okay. I mean, okay. I feel like I'm starting to understand where you're coming from better than before. And I think that's a perfect segue... into both of us have been reading and or listening, depending on what your attention span is. I tend to listen to books. Mike,
I read them, but
smarter than me, reads them. And we've got a great book. It's called This Naked Mind. The author is Annie Grace, correct?
Correct.
I only know that because you've said it. And it's really interesting. She touches on a lot of I want to say they're alternative recovery, but a lot of it just seems like common sense. And if you're like me and you've spent years and years and years in traditional recovery programs, hearing and reading this Naked Mind philosophy just sounds like it's like sunshine. You're like, wow, that makes a lot of sense. And a lot of it is she's talking about, you know, just your common sense and basically logically taking apart, you know, your addiction and what it's doing to you. And I think it's really been helpful for me, honestly, you know, as I make my way sort of without a program in the last year or so. It's really helped me. And I think for Mike, too, it gave him some really interesting perspectives on his own recovery.
It did. And any story which bears a little going into was what I found attractive, because she kind of lived the trajectory that I was living. She was in advertising so a professional environment that required a lot of drinking. You know, we touched on that last week. All professional environments require a lot of drinking. But anyway, she, after years and years of going out on these, you know, work dinners and drinks afterwards and conferences and so forth, she realized that the alcohol was starting to take over and the work stuff was just sort of, you know, of lesser importance, you know. So she got tired of waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, every morning, not knowing how much wine she had drank the night before, and decided to really take a scientific look at what it was about alcohol that seemed to be so unique or so common that everybody who got involved with drinking at that level tended to run into some kind of a problem.
Right. And she goes into a lot of the psyche of people shop. And me, I've been in marketing since 2000 professionally. And I really, you know, got a lot out of her analysis about how alcohol is just pervasive. And one of the things you notice when you quit drinking is just how much drinking is pushed in our faces at all stops. Everywhere you look, there's a beer commercial. There's always a situation that you're being shown on TV and a billboard and whatever it is, where they're romanticizing the drinking of alcohol. And she really takes apart what it is that, you know, we're all seeing and sort of, you know, takes off takes it away so that you can see it for what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's very strange that we live in our society is structured that people who are not ingesting what's essentially a poison,
yeah,
are considered the ones with the problem. But the people who, yeah, for whom it's a normal thing to drink ethanol, which is the same stuff, right, that you put in the gas tank of your car, that's the normal behavior.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it seems like upside down world. Really.
It is. And she really portrays alcohol as a poison. And, you know, she talks about, you know, scientific experiments where, you know, how the rats completely disregard alcohol unless forced to drink it, at which point they have to drink it, you know? And then that's sort of the point, I think, is that as human beings, it's not good for us to drink any amount of alcohol, you know? And how she sort of portrays alcoholics as everybody is a potential alcoholic. And even the term alcoholic for her, from her point of view, is sort of not really covering what's really going on here, and that it's an addictive substance, proven, not only an addictive substance, but a carcinogen, a proven carcinogen at any amount. And just the wonderment as to how this carcinogen poison, you know, which is potentially addictive to not just alcoholics, but everybody who imbibes, is at risk. And that definitely cast it in a different light for me.
She used a great analogy of the pitcher plant.
Yes. Yeah, I like that. I like the pitcher. And does everybody know what a pitcher plant is? If you know what a Venus flytrap is, the next one next to the Venus flytrap is a pitcher plant.
The pitcher plant works a little differently from a Venus flytrap, right, because it's hollow and it's a long tube, and it produces this lovely nectar that attracts the bugs. And if you're a bug and you sit at the top of the pitcher plant, and you put a little bit on your lips, you think, geez, you know, there's some more down there. And the further down you go, you're drinking all this nectar, and then you realize belatedly that it's impossible for you to turn around and climb back up and out. And that's the allegory that she uses for alcohol, that we're all just sort of, anybody who is drinking alcohol in any degree runs the risk of ending up at the bottom of the pitcher plant, if you will.
Right. And that we're not to be divided into people with, quote, addictive personalities. If you're listening to this podcast, you have at one point or another probably been identified as someone with an addictive personality. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once you have been identified as such, you think to yourself, well, yeah, I guess I am. I really like, you know, science fiction, and I bought too many science fiction books, and I went into comics, and I couldn't stop myself. And then I bought the Doctor Who, you know, the merchandise, and I couldn't stop buying it. And you start to think of all these different things. But the truth is, according to Annie Grace, is that everybody is ingesting a poisonous addictive substance, and there is no such thing as an addictive personality. And she does point to studies, which I don't have written down unless you do, that say that, and that we're all at risk. So it's really just, according to this book, This Naked Mind, how far along on the path you are. You're either, you know, like I was, and like Mike, you know, at the bottom, or you're one of these people who have to have a drink after work every day. And you have to have a drink every time you go out with your friends, and that even if it's two drinks, if it's one drink a day, you are still slowly whittling away at your ability to maintain that, and that ultimately the drink wins, I think, is what she's
right. You know. And that, you know, it varies, the amount of time it takes, or the trajectory varies from person to person.
Yeah, she doesn't say it. She says it's not a brain disease,
right,
which is going to piss off a lot of people who spend a lot of money, you know, doing these studies. And anybody who's been to a recovery place, for lack of a better term, you know, these inpatients, outpatients, it's a disease. You're diseased, you know. So what does that mean? Is there really anybody who can successfully go out and drink a beer with dinner once a week and have absolutely no negative repercussions?
There may be.
According to Andy Grace, they are very, very few and far between.
Right.
And it made me think, you know, because when anybody makes a claim like that, that goes against everything, you know, you thought you knew, you have to question it. And then you go back and think about the people you know who you think are just like regular drinkers. And you go, do I think they could be going down the path of addiction? I mean, I did that very thing, thinking about the people close to me. I thought about my wife, who I never thought of as an addict or an alcoholic. She was one of those people that we used to party in when we first met, and then miraculously she quit, and that's how a lot of friction started in our relationship, where she could take it or leave it. And I was like, leave it, you know, what are you talking about? still have to record a concept album, and you know, I'm not done yet, but she could. But to see these people and look at their drinking now from that perspective, it really made me kind of rethink, like, are they getting lured in by that pitcher plant?
Somebody said to me a few years ago that you can be addicted to alcohol even if you only drink one drink a day.
Yeah.
And at the time, I thought that was a ludicrous statement.
Sure.
Until, you know, I started realizing that's not ludicrous at all, because if you're having that one drink a day, and when you don't get that drink, you know, a certain time of that day rolls around and your brain starts firing off all that shit.
You're looking forward to that.
Right. And you arrange your life around it, you know, and that to me is addiction.
Yeah. You know, some bullet points, and you know, I'd like to refer to my bullet points, because I'm getting very organized about this podcast.
You're more organized than I am. That's
no,
for sure.
You know, because look, I'm a music school dropout, and Mike has a Juris Doctorate. Okay, let's just start there. So I've been making these the Google Docs, and then I'll start out making like show notes that have bullet points, and I'm just thinking, okay, I want a couple of points, and I'm going to refer to it, and then blah blah blah, and then I send it to Mike, and then I get it back from him, and there's like, it's a dissertation. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I can't read this on the
air. I know.
Air.
I should be synthesizing data in a much more concise manner.
I can't look. I have to have the most basic. Okay, so so far I've had to make a second outline.
Let me just bring something up that maybe it's not a contradiction, but maybe it is. You know, you were saying how Annie says that alcoholism is not a brain disease necessarily.
She does, right?
But then she also says that the reason why she doesn't recommend moderation, or why moderation is impossible, is because your brain physically and chemically changes forever.
Yeah, she also says you don't know when it's going to go over that edge.
Right.
When the pickle becomes, no, when cucumber, the cucumber becomes a pickle.
So,
right?
So is that a disease? Is your brain changing so that you can no longer, you know?
Right.
You see the contradiction?
Right.
You're speaking of a biological process in the brain.
Okay.
But then you're saying it's not a disease.
So I think when she says disease, she's talking about like something you're either born with or developed genetically somehow, like diabetes
So disease is different from a physical addiction to alcohol.
I think she's making that, you know, that separation. I think, you know, I think her point, which is a good one, is that this addictive poison that we have been tricked into consuming happily at dinners. She even talks about, and I got a lot out of her description of like, the way that they present wine. You know, it's this huge. And when I went to Italy with my wife, we went to one of these vineyards, and they teach you how to like, it goes in the glass.
It's a
right?
fetish.
Sure. It's a whole thing. And then you shake it around using your first finger and your middle finger, and you shake it around, and you know, depending on how long it takes the liquid to drip down the side of the glass, well, that's how viscous. It's better if it's slow.
Content of the alcohol,
right? Yeah. You put it in your nose, you smell it, and then you drink it, and it's this whole process, and it's so romantic, and that this is just straight up marketing.
Yeah.
And I love that idea. Like, as a marketing guy, I'm like, wow, look what they have done. It's amazing. It's brilliant. They've taken this poison, this thing that is really destroying lives and killing people, and they've made it romantic.
Yeah. I mean, you just think about the ambiance of the wine cellar.
Oh yeah.
The beauty of trellises of grapes across the countryside. I mean, I started looking at, you know, that whole, you know, knowledge of wine and learning everything about wine.
You get a degree.
Sort of like graduate school for alcoholics.
Sure. Sommelier can tell you exactly how you can get drunk with a steak.
And, you know, now they're doing it with beer too. You know,
beer
the whole craft beer movement.
The craft beer and the ironic t-shirts, hats, and beards, right? You've got to have it all.
And then everyone who says that alcohol, you know, you have to pair alcohol with food, when in reality, the science shows that alcohol dulls the taste buds.
It just destroys the flavor of the food. You know?
Right?
Like if you're eating something so delicate as like a piece of sushi, and then you ruin it with, you know, some horrible way wine, that's just,
Or even sake, which tastes alcohol to me.
You know, but it is brilliant. And it's definitely to be able to see it from a clear head, from where, like, I would like to think we have somewhat of a clear head where we can look at this and go, you're not fooling me.
Right.
Right. And to listen to Annie Grace's book and to listen, I mean, she's very logical. And what she recommends, and I do have one amongst other issues with her points, right? And I notated this mentally when I heard it, when I was listening to the book, because it all sounds great. which is basically she's appealing to your logic. She's appealing to your knowledge, your intelligence, right? But it's not like your intelligence when you're first trying to kick. Like, forget it when it's too late and you're addicted. Like, that doesn't matter. When I first went into rehab, the people that were trying to help me said, get stupid. Stop thinking like this. Stop trying to figure it out. Stop. Just do what we tell you. Right.
But then we're full circle on right? not everything works for every person the same way, because I think you don't pick up a book like This Naked Mind unless you've made at least a half-ass commitment to yourself to stop drinking in the first place.
But I can't even imagine myself when I was like just off of my DWI and I was court mandated all this crap.
Well, there it is.
To read that book, it wouldn't do nothing for me.
You were court mandated.
Absolutely.
Were you 100%. Saying to yourself, man, I got to stop this shit?
Absolutely not. I was in a situation that many of us find ourselves in where we're in these groups and we basically, life has said to us under no uncertain terms, you can't drink anymore, whether we want to or not. And then you have to find a way. And a book like that would not have helped me in that scenario. Now it's great, but at that time, I needed a fix.
One of the interesting things about the book that she says is you don't need to stop drinking to start reading the book.
Yeah. I saw that.
So if you're drinking, like, don't start drinking if you've stopped already.
I had my third drink by the fourth chapter.
but if you are drinking, you know, just try not to read it while you're actually drinking. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, not every resource is going to work for every person.
That's true.
But I mean, if you have issues with the sort of more woo-woo side of 12-step and you want maybe to take a look at something else, I would think it's a good place to start.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Look, where I'm at right now, I got a lot out of the book. I really liked it because it appealed to my intellectual side. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you that my intellectual side, and yes, look, you were never in the same situation I was, which is court mandated.
Right.
And I don't know if you were ever put in this, if they call it wife mandated. Was your wife ever like, you get sober or this is it? Lose your kids.
On the contrary, I think my wife is a little disappointed she lost a drinking buddy.
Look, so that would separate us off the bat, right?
My wife
there.
Doesn't drink to excess, by the way. Just get that out there.
She doesn't.
She's a glass a night drinker.
And can I just say, she's really cool.
Isn't she?
She's awesome. And so that's a big difference between Mike and I right off the bat. So, I mean, maybe that's something that we can, you know, learn something from. You know, I was literally forced into recovery. And for me, it wasn't just the law. It was my family. And then it was my life. And I'll get into that.
Those are powerful motivators, though.
Yeah, I got very far down, but I really do like This Naked Mind by Annie Grace. I highly recommend it. If you're one of the more intellectuals who can take it or leave it, and you're just kind of pontificating about sobriety, it's a good one.
If nothing else, it'll open your eyes to the way the marketing industry has taken alcohol and shoved it down everybody's throat.
That alone
normalized it.
That alone is just like very, very interesting. Okay. So, I mean, we could talk about this book a lot. I don't know how much into the weeds we want to get with it. So we are going to move on.
Right.
From This Naked Mind. I think we wanted to go on to Middle Ages recovery in the news. We had a couple of stories.
Yes. Recovery in the news.
What is that? That's great. That's like a that's a cool lick.
Thank you.
That's like, did you write that? No, of course not.
It came with the board. I just punched the button.
That's really good, man. I would listen to that. So we've got a great story, or a horrifying story. Recovery in the news. Mike, back to you.
Oh, we're going to do that story. Okay.
You know, so, the guy getting slapped.
Right. So,
the slap
guy. We've just spent a bit of time talking about the normalization of alcohol in society. And something was in the Times last week, where I guess in China, they take the drinking culture even more seriously than we do here on Wall Street. There was a guy who had made it known upon his hiring that he was not a big drinker, but he had to go out with the boss. Yep. And the boss was trying to pour drinks down his throat all night. And after the third or fourth refusal by this guy, his boss hauled back and smacked him right across the face.
Him.
And he was very embarrassed. He got up to leave the banquet, and then all of his coworkers jeered at him and threw drinks at him as he walked out.
Can you imagine? You're trying to stay sober and they're slapping and jeering at you. College.
I don't think it's quite that bad here in the U.S., but anyway, it opened up a big conversation in China about drinking culture. The guy ended up getting kept his job, and his bosses got their bonuses taken away.
Yes, their bonuses. But, so anytime you think that you've got pressure at work to drink.
Yeah, it's not as bad as that poor guy.
And listen, we talked about this. I had pressure in marketing to drink. But, in legal, you had corporate legal, you have pressure to drink. But when I was working for myself, working from home, by myself, and all my employees lived elsewhere, I had pressure to drink because I was an alcoholic, or am an alcoholic. And more controversially, I'm a recovered alcoholic. So, right. There's always pressure to drink. And so that was a good story. And we want to keep these stories in the news. I've got one more story for you. This is crazy stories in the news. Pilots report seeing, quote, guy in jetpack flying near LAX. In a bizarre story out of Los Angeles, the pilot of a jet coming in for a landing at LAX reported seeing a person in a jetpack flying alongside their aircraft. The very strange incident reportedly occurred on Sunday evening as an American Airlines flight was headed towards Los Angeles International Airport. The normal routine task of landing the plane took a weird turn when the pilot looked out of his window and spotted a proverbial, quote, rocketeer in the sky next to the airliner. I think there were some problems with copy there, but I did my best with it. So there was a rocketeer near LAX.
Kudos to that guy for social distancing. I mean, you don't want to get on that airplane surrounding yourself with people. Get your own jetpack. Was it Elon Musk by chance?
It doesn't say. I just like to say I get these crazy headlines from Coast to Coast AM. It's one of my favorite shows. It's a radio show, and I get these funny headlines, and I think more people should hear them. And so that's our crazy news for the day.
All right.
There it is.
That's it.
I feel like I need a circus. I need for that. But I think we got to wrap it up here.
Yeah, we're coming up on our time. We're like at an hour now.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. I'd like to thank everybody for listening to us on episode 3. Please check us out. We've got a Facebook page. It's Recovery in the Middle Ages on Facebook. Also iTunes, rate, review, and send us an email. We'll read your reviews on the air. That would be really great. Please check back again next week. We are dropping every week.
Yep.
Every week we're going to drop. Until we drop. As we say here, non proficiat perfectum.
Progress, not perfection.
That's it.
All right.
See you next week.
Be good.